Chapter 2. In the beginning, of course, and the beginning for him was nearly 2 centuries before his visit to the surgeon's office, no one could have mistaken Andrew Martin for anything but the robot he was. In that long-ago era when he had first come from the assembly line of United States robots and mechanical men, he was as much a robot in appearance as any that had ever existed, smoothly designed and magnificently functional, a sleek mechanical object, a positronic brain encased in a more or less humanoid-looking housing made from metal and plastic. His long, slim limbs, then, were finely articulated mechanisms fashioned from titanium alloys overlaid by steel and equipped with silicone bushings at the joints to prevent metal-to-metal contact. His limb sockets were of the finest flexible polyethylene. His eyes were photoelectric cells that gleamed with a deep red glow. His face, and to call it that was charitable, it was the merest perfunctory sketch of a face, was altogether incapable of expression. His bare, sexless body was unambiguously a manufactured device. All it took was a single glance to see that he was a machine, no more animate, no more human, no more alive than a telephone or a pocket calculator or an automobile. But that was in another era, long, long ago. It was an era when robots were still uncommon sights on Earth. Almost the very dawn of the age of robotics, not much more than a generation after the days when the great early roboticists like Alfred Lanning and Peter Bogert and the legendary robot psychologist Susan Calvin had done their historic work, developing and perfecting the principles by which the first positronic robots had come into being. The aim of those pioneers had been to create robots capable of taking up many of the dreary burdens that human beings had for so long been compelled to bear. And that was part of the problem that the roboticists faced in those dawning days of the science of artificial life late in the 20th century and early in the 21st, the unwillingness of a great many human beings to surrender those burdens to mechanical substitutes. Because of that unwillingness, strict laws had been passed in virtually every country. The world was still broken up into a multitude of nations then against the use of robot labor on Earth. By the year 2007, they had been banned entirely everywhere on the planet, except for scientific research under carefully controlled conditions. Robots could be sent into space, yes, to the ever-multiplying industrial factories and exploratory stations off Earth. Let them cope with the miseries of frigid Ganymede and torrid Mercury. Let them put up with the inconveniences of scrabbling around on the surface of Luna. Let them run the bewildering risks of the early jump experiments that would eventually give mankind the hyperspace roads to the stars. But robots in free and general use on Earth, occupying precious slots in the labor force that would otherwise be available for actual naturally born flesh and blood human beings? No. No. No robots wanted around here. Well, that had eventually begun to change, of course, and the most dramatic changes had begun to set in around the time that robot NDR-113, who would someday be known as Andrew Martin, had been undergoing assembly at the main northern region factory of United States robots and mechanical men. One of the factors bringing about the gradual breakdown of the anti-robot prejudices on Earth at the time was simple public relations. United States Robots and Mechanical Men was not only a scientifically adept organization, it knew a thing or two about the importance of maintaining its profitability, too. So it had found ways, quiet and subtle and effective, of chipping away at the Frankenstein myth of the robot, the concept of the mechanical man as the dreaded shambling golem. Robots are here for our convenience, the USRMM public relations people said. Robots are here to help us. Robots are not our enemies. Robots are perfectly safe, safe beyond any possibility of doubt. And because, in fact, all those things were actually true, people began to accept the presence of robots among them. They did so grudgingly in the main. Many people, most perhaps, were still uncomfortable with the whole idea of robots, but they recognized the need for them and they could at least tolerate having them around so long as tight restrictions on their use continued to be applied. There was need for robots, like it or not, because the population of Earth had started to dwindle about that time. After the long anguish that was the 20th century, a time of relative tranquility and harmony and even rationality, a certain degree of that anyway, had begun to settle over the world. It became a quieter, calmer, happier place. There were fewer people by far, not because there had been terrible wars and plagues, but because families now tended to be smaller, giving preference to quality over quantity. Migration to the newly settled worlds of space was draining off some of Earth's population also. Migration to the extensive network of underground settlements on the moon, to the colonies in the asteroid belt, and on the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, and to the artificial worlds in orbit around Earth and Mars. So there was no longer so much excitement over the possibility of losing one's job to a robot. The fear of job shortages on Earth had given way to the problem of labor shortages. Suddenly, the robots that once had been looked upon with such uneasiness, fear, and even hatred became necessary to maintain the welfare of a world that had every material advantage but didn't have enough of a population left to sweep the streets, drive the taxis, cook the meals, stoke the furnaces. It was in this new era of diminishing population and increasing prosperity that NDR 113, the future Andrew Martin, was manufactured. No longer was the use of robots illegal on Earth, but strict regulations still applied, and they were still far from everyday sights, especially robots who were programmed for ordinary household duties, which was the primary use that Gerald Martin had in mind for NDR 113. Hardly anyone in those days had a robot servant around the house. It was too frightening an idea for most people, and too expensive besides. But Gerald Martin was hardly just anyone. He was a member of the regional legislature, a powerful member at that, chairman of the Science and Technology Committee, a man of great presence and authority, of tremendous force of mind and character. What Gerald Martin set out to achieve, Gerald Martin inevitably succeeded in achieving. And what Gerald Martin chose to possess, Gerald Martin would invariably come to possess. He believed in robots. He knew that they were an inevitable development, that they would ultimately become inextricably enmeshed in human society at every level. And so, utilizing his position on the Science and Technology Committee to the fullest, he had been able to arrange for robots to become a part of his private life and that of his family. For the sake of gaining a deeper understanding of the robot phenomenon, he had explained. For the sake of helping his fellow members of the regional legislature to discover how they might best grapple with the problems that the coming era of robotic ubiquity would bring. Bravely, magnanimously, Gerald Martin had offered himself as an experimental subject and had volunteered to take a small group of domestic robots into his own home. The first robots that arrived were simple, specialized ones dedicated to specific routine tasks. They were approximately human in form, but they had little, if anything, to say, and went about their business in their quiet, efficient manner of the machines that they all too plainly were. At first, the Martins found it strange to have them around, but very quickly they faded into the background of the family's existence, arousing no more interest than toasters or vacuum cleaners would. But then...
"This is NDR 113,
Gerald Martin announced one cool, windy afternoon in June, when the delivery truck had rolled up the long driveway that led to the imposing cliff-top estate of the Gerald Martin family, and the sleek, shining mechanical man had been released from his crate.
"Our personal household robot, our own private family retainer."
"What did you call him?"
Amanda asked. Amanda was the younger of the two Martin daughters, a small, golden-haired child with penetrating blue eyes. She was just beginning to learn to read and write then.
"NDR 113.
"Is that his name?"
"His serial number, actually."
Amanda frowned.
"NDR. NDR 113. That's a peculiar name."
"Serial number,"
Gerald Martin said again. But Amanda wanted no part of that.
"NDR. We can't call him something like that. It doesn't sound like any kind of name anything ought to have."
"Listen to her," Melissa Martin said. Melissa was the older Martin girl, 5 years older than Amanda, dark-haired, dark-eyed. Melissa was practically a woman, so far as Melissa was concerned. Amanda was merely a child, and therefore Melissa regarded her as foolish by definition.
She doesn't like the robot's serial number.
N-D-R,
Amanda said again, elaborately paying no attention to Melissa.
That isn't any good. It really isn't. What about calling him Andrew?
Andrew? Gerald Martin said.
It's got an N in it, doesn't it? And a D?
For a moment, Amanda looked a little doubtful.
Sure it does. And an R? That much I'm certain of. N-D-R. Andrew!
Just listen to her,
Melissa said scornfully. But Gerald Martin was smiling. He knew that it wasn't at all unusual to adapt a robot's serial letters into a name. Robots of the JN series tended to become Johns or Janes. RG robots became Archies. QT robots were called Cuties. Well, here was an NDR series robot, and Amanda wanted to call him Andrew. Fine, fine. Gerald Martin had a way of letting Amanda do what Amanda thought was best for Amanda, within limits, of course.
Very well,
he said.
Andrew it is.
And Andrew it was. So much so that, as the years went along, no one in the Martin family ever called him NDR-113 again. In time, his serial number was forgotten altogether, and it had to be looked up whenever he needed to be taken in for maintenance. Andrew himself claimed to have forgotten his own number. Of course, that wasn't strictly true. No matter how much time might go by, he could never forget anything, not if he wanted to remember it. But as time went on and things began to change for Andrew, he had less and less desire to remember the number. He left it safely hidden away in the oblivion of his memory banks and never thought of going searching for it. He was Andrew now, Andrew Martin, the Andrew of the Martin family. Andrew was tall and slender and graceful, because that was how NDR robots were designed to look. He moved quietly and unobtrusively around the splendid house that the Martin family occupied overlooking the Pacific, efficiently doing all the Martins required him to do. It was a house out of a vanished age, a grand and majestic mansion that really required a grand retinue of servants to keep it up. But of course there were no servants to be had any longer, except for robots, and that had been causing some problems for the Martins before Gerald Martin offered himself up for this experiment. Now a pair of robot gardeners tended the glistening green lawns and pruned the glorious hedges of fiery red azaleas and trimmed away the dead fronds of the towering palm trees that ran along the ridge behind the house. A robot house cleaner kept dust and cobwebs at bay, and Andrew, the robot, served as valet, butler, lady's maid, and chauffeur for the Martin family. He prepared meals, he selected and poured the wines of which Gerald Martin was so fond. He supervised their wardrobes. He arranged and cared for their fine furniture, their works of art, their myriad distinctive possessions. Andrew had one other duty, too, which in fact monopolized much of his time to the detriment of the rest of his formal household routine. The Martin estate, for that was what it was, nothing less, a great estate, was an isolated one, alone on its beautiful ridge overlooking the chilly blue ocean. There was a little town nearby, but it was some distance away. The nearest city of any size, San Francisco, was far down the coast. Cities were starting to become obsolete now, anyway, and people preferred to communicate electronically and keep plenty of distance between one house and the next. So the Martin girls, in their grand and wonderful isolation, had very few playmates. They did, however, have Andrew. It was Miss who first figured out how that might best be arranged. Miss was what Andrew invariably called Melissa, not because he was incapable of pronouncing her first name, but because it seemed improper to him to address her in such a familiar way. Amanda was always Little Miss, never anything else. Mrs. Martin, Lucy was her first name, was Ma'am to Andrew. And as for Gerald Martin, he was Sir. Gerald Martin was the sort of individual whom many people, not simply robots, felt most comfortable calling Sir. The number of people in the world who called him Gerald was a very small number indeed, and it was impossible to suppose him being Jerry to anybody at all. Miss quickly came to understand more than a little about how to take advantage of the presence of a robot in the house. It was a simple matter of utilizing the second law.
Andrew, she said, we order you to stop what you're doing and play with us.
At the moment, Andrew was arranging the books in the Martin Library, which had wandered a little out of alphabetical order, as books have a way of doing. He paused and looked down from the high mahogany bookcase between the two great leaded glass windows at the north end of the room. Mildly, he said, "I'm sorry, miss. I'm occupied at present by a task requested by your father. A prior order from Sir must take precedence over this request of yours."
"I heard what Daddy told you," Miss replied. "He said, I'd like you to tidy up those books, Andrew. Get them back into some kind of sensible arrangement. Isn't that so?"
"That is exactly what he said, yes, miss. Those were his very words."
"Well, then, if all he said was that he'd like you to tidy up those books, and you don't deny that he did, then it wasn't much of an order, was it? It was more of a preference, a suggestion. A suggestion isn't an order, neither is a preference. Andrew, I order you. Leave the books where they are and come take Amanda and me for a walk along the beach."
It was a perfect application of the second law. Andrew put the books down immediately and descended from his ladder. Sir was the head of the household, but he hadn't actually given an order, not in the formal sense of the concept, and Miss had. She certainly had. And an order from a human member of this household, any human member of the household, had to take priority over a mere expression of preference from some other human member of the household, even if that member happened to be Sir himself. Not that Andrew had any problem with any of that. He was fond of Miss, and even more fond of little Miss. At least, the effect that they had upon his actions was that which in a human being would have been called the result of fondness. Andrew thought of it as fondness, for he didn't know any other term for what he felt toward the two girls. Certainly he felt something. That in itself was a little odd, but he supposed that a capacity for fondness had been built into him, the way his various other skills had been. And so if they wanted him to come out and play with them, he'd do it happily, provided they made it permissible for him to do it within the context of the three laws. The trail down to the beach was a steep and winding one, strewn with rocks and gopher holes and other troublesome obstacles. No one but Miss and Little Miss used it very often, because the beach itself was nothing more than a ragged sandy strand covered with driftwood and storm-tossed seaweed, and the ocean in this northern part of California was far too chilly for anyone without a wetsuit to consider entering, but the girls loved its bleak, moody, wind-swept charm. As they scrambled down the trail, Andrew held Miss by the hand and carried Little Miss in the crook of his arm. Very likely both girls could have made their way down the path without incident, but Sir had been very strict about the beach trail.
"Make sure they don't run or jump around, Andrew. If they tripped over something in the wrong place, it would be a 50-foot drop. I can't stop them from going down there, but I want you to be right beside them at all times to be certain they don't do anything foolish. That's an order."
One of these days, Andrew knew, Miss or even Little Miss was going to countermand that order and tell him to stand aside while they ran giddily down the hill to the beach. When that happened, it would set up a powerful equipotential of contradiction in his positronic brain, and beyond much doubt, he would be hard-pressed to deal with it. Sir's order would ultimately prevail, naturally, since it embodied elements of the first law as well as the second, and anything that involved first law prohibitions always took highest priority. Still, Andrew knew that his circuitry would be stressed more than a little the first time a direct conflict between Sir's decree and the girl's whims came into play. For the moment, though, Miss and Little Miss were content to abide by the rules. Carefully, step by step, he made his way down the face of the cliff with the girls in tow. At the bottom, Andrew released Miss's hand and set Little Miss down on the damp sand. Immediately they went streaking off, running gleefully along the edge of the fierce, snarling sea.
"Seaweed!"
Miss cried, grabbing up a thick, brown, ropey length of kelp that was longer than she was and swinging it like a whip.
"Look at this big chunk of seaweed, Andrew!"
"And this piece of driftwood," said Little Miss. "Isn't it beautiful, Melissa?"
"Maybe to you," the older girl said loftily. She took the gnarled and bent bit of wood from Little Miss, examined it in a perfunctory way, and tossed it aside with a shudder.
"Ugh! It's got things growing on it."
"They're just another kind of seaweed," Little Miss said. "Right, Andrew?"
She picked up the discarded piece of driftwood and handed it to him for inspection. Algae, yes, he said.
Algae?
Algae, the technical term for seaweed.
Oh, algae.
Little Miss laughed and put the bit of driftwood down near the beginning of the trail so she would remember to take it with her when they went up to the house again. Then she rampaged off down the beach again, following her older sister through the foamy fringes of the surf. Andrew kept pace with them without difficulty. He did not intend to let them get very far from him at any time. He had needed no special orders from Sir to protect the girls while they were actually on the beach. The first law took care of that. The ocean here was not only wild-looking but exceedingly dangerous. The currents were strong and unpredictable. The water was intolerably cold at almost any time of the year, and the great rocky fangs of a deadly reef rose from the swirling breakers less than 50 meters offshore. If Miss or Little Miss should make the slightest move to enter the sea, Andrew would be beside them in an instant. But they had more sense than to want to go swimming in this impossible ocean. The shore along this part of the Pacific coast was a beautiful thing to behold in its harsh, bleak way, but the sea itself, forever angry and turbulent, was the enemy of those who were not bred for it, and even a small child could see that at a glance. Miss and Little Miss were wading in the tide pools now, peering at the dark periwinkles and gray-green limpets and pink and purple anemones and the myriad little scuttling hermit crabs, and searching, as they always did, rarely with much luck, for a starfish. Andrew stood nearby, poised and ready in the event that a sudden wave should rise without warning nearby and sweep toward shore. The sea was quiet today, as quiet as that savage body of water ever got, but perilous waves were apt to come out of nowhere at any time. Miss said suddenly,
Andrew, do you know how to swim?
I could do it if it were necessary, Miss.
It wouldn't short-circuit your brain or anything, if water got in it, I mean.
I am very well insulated, Andrew told her.
Good. Swim out to that gray rock and back, then. The ones where the cormorants are nesting. I want to see how fast you can do it.
Melissa,
said Little Miss uneasily.
Shh, Amanda. I want Andrew to go out there. Maybe he can find some cormorant eggs and bring them back to show us.
It would not be good to disturb the nest, Miss, said Andrew gently.
I said I wanted you to go out there.
Melissa,
Little Miss said again, more sharply. But Miss was insistent. It was an order. Andrew felt the preliminary signs of contradictory potentials building up. A faint trembling in his fingertips, a barely perceptible sense of vertigo, be obeyed. That was the second law. Miss could order him to swim to China this minute, and Andrew would do it without hesitation if no other considerations were involved. But he was here to protect the girls. What would happen if something unexpected befell them while he was out by the cormorant rock? A sudden menacing wave, a rock slide, even an earthquake. Earthquakes weren't everyday occurrences here, but they certainly could happen at any time. It was a pure first law issue. I'm sorry, Miss. With no adults here to guard you, I am unable to leave you unattended long enough to swim to that rock and back. If sir or ma'am were present, that would be a different matter. But as it is...
Don't you recognize an order when you hear one? I want you to swim out there, Andrew!
As I have explained, Miss...
You don't have to worry about us. It's not as though I'm a child, Andrew. What do you think, that some sort of terrible ogre is going to come down the beach and gobble us up while you're in the water? I can look after myself, thank you, and I'll take care of Amanda, too, if I have to.
Little Miss said,
You aren't being fair to him, Melissa. He's got his orders from Daddy.
And now he has his orders from me,
Miss gestured peremptorily.
Swim out to the cormorant rock, Andrew. Go ahead. Now, Andrew.
Andrew felt himself growing a little warm and ordered his circuitry to make the necessary homeostatic correction.
The first law, he began.
What a bore you are! You and your first law both, cried Melissa. Can't you forget the first law once in a while? But no, no, you can't do that, can you? You've got those silly laws wired into you and there's no getting around them. You're nothing but a dumb machine. Melissa!
Little Miss said indignantly.
Yes, that is true, said Andrew. As you correctly state, I am nothing but a dumb machine, and therefore I have no ability to countermand your father's order concerning your safety on the beach. He bowed slightly in Melissa's direction. I deeply regret this, miss. Little Miss said,
If you want to see Andrew swim so much, Melissa, why don't you just have him wade into the surf and do some swimming right close to shore? There wouldn't be any harm in that, would there? It wouldn't be the same thing, Miss said, pouting.
Not at all.
But Andrew reflected, perhaps that would satisfy her. He disliked being the focus of so much disharmony. Let me show you, he said. He waded in. The heavy foam-flecked surf thundered up violently around his knees, but Andrew was able easily to adjust his gyroscopic stabilizers as the force of the breaking waves assailed him. The rough, sharp rocks that were scattered all over the sea floor meant nothing to his metallic treads. His sensors told him that the temperature of the water was well below human comfort tolerance, but that too was irrelevant to him. 4 or 5 meters out, the water was deep enough so that Andrew could swim in it, and yet he was still close enough to shore to be able to get back to land in a moment if need be. He doubted that need would be. The girls stood side by side on the beach, watching him in fascination. Andrew had never gone swimming before. There had never been the slightest reason for him to do so. But he had been programmed for grace and coordination under all circumstances, and it took him no more than a microsecond to calculate the nature of the motions necessary to propel him through the water just below the surface. The rhythmic kicking of the legs, the lifting of the arms, the cupping of the hands. Deftly he glided along, parallel to the shore for perhaps a dozen meters, swimming smoothly, efficiently, powerfully. Then he turned and returned to his starting point. The whole excursion had taken just a few moments, and it had had the desired effect on Miss.
You're a wonderful swimmer, Andrew, she told him. Her eyes were shining. I'm sure you'd break all the records if you ever entered a swimming meet.
There are no swimming meets for robots, Miss, Andrew told her gravely. Miss giggled.
I mean a human swimming meet, like in the Olympics.
Oh, Miss, how unfair that would be if they allowed a robot to compete in the Olympics against humans. It could never happen. She considered that for a moment.
I suppose not, she said.
Wistfully, she looked toward the cormorant rock.
Are you sure you won't swim out there? I bet you could get there and back in 2 minutes. What could possibly happen to us in 2 minutes? Melissa,
Little Miss said again. Andrew said, I completely understand your desire to have me do it, Miss, but I am not able to fulfill your wish. Again, I deeply regret.
Oh, all right. I'm sorry I asked.
You aren't,
Little Miss said.
I am. And you called Andrew a dumb machine. That wasn't nice.
It's true, isn't it? Miss asked. He told us himself that it was true.
He's a machine, I suppose,
Little Miss conceded.
But he isn't dumb at all. And anyway, it wasn't a polite thing for you to say. I don't have to be polite to robots. It's like being polite to a television set. It's different,
Little Miss insisted.
It's entirely different.
And then she was crying, and Andrew had to scoop her up and whirl her around until she was so distracted by the vast, cloudless sweep of the sky and the strangeness of the upside-down ocean that she forgot why she had been upset. A little while afterward, Miss came up to him, while Little Miss was poking in the tide pools again, and said in a low, contrite voice,
I'm sorry I said what I did, Andrew.
That's all right, Miss.
Will you forgive me? I know it wasn't nice. I really wanted you to swim out there, and I didn't stop to think that you aren't allowed to leave us alone when we're down here. I'm very sorry, Andrew.
There's no need for you to apologize, Miss. Truly there isn't. Nor was there. How could a robot possibly take offense at anything a human said or did? But somehow, Andrew thought it best not to point that out to her just now. If Miss felt a need to apologize, he must permit her to fulfill that need,
even though her cruel words had not disturbed him in the first place. It would be absurd for him to deny that he was a machine. That was exactly what he was. And as for being a dumb machine, well, he had no real idea of what she had meant by that. He had adequate intelligence capacity to meet the needs placed upon him. Doubtless there were robots more intelligent than he was, but he had not encountered them. Had she meant that he was less intelligent than humans are? The statement was meaningless to him. He knew no way of comparing robot intelligence with human intelligence. Quantitatively and qualitatively, their manners of thinking were two entirely different processes. Everyone was agreed on that. Soon the wind became chillier. It whipped the girls' dresses about and hurled showers of sand in their faces and against Andrew's shining hull. The girls decided that they had had enough of playing on the beach. As they started toward the path, Little Miss picked up the piece of driftwood that she had found before and tucked it through her belt. She was always collecting strange little treasures of that sort. That evening, when he was off duty, Andrew went down to the beach by himself and swam out to the Cormorant Rock simply to see how long it would take. Even in the darkness, he managed it easily and swiftly. Very likely, Andrew realized now, he could have managed it without exposing Miss and Little Miss to any great period of risk. Not that he would have done so, but it would have been possible. No one had requested Andrew to make the nighttime swim to the rock. It was entirely his own idea, a matter of curiosity, so to speak.